Time for Wrigley's Spearmint.
The March of Time.
The makers of Wrigley's Spearmint Gum are the best-known makers of gum in the world. The editors of Time are the best-known historians of the news. So Wrigley's asks the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine, to prepare and present, for your enjoyment, their reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the world.
From the March of Time.
Thursday, May 14th, 1936. Today, still tense, is the little New Jersey town of Somerville, where late afternoon yesterday, a sudden streak of lightning tears through the low black skies as crashes of thunder roar to the driving rain. In the yards of the Standard Oil Company and the Public Service Electric and Gas Company stand two giant aluminum tanks. As the 45-year-old plant superintendent, George Crayley, sits in a little cubby hut, looks through the rain-drenched haze. Suddenly, a half-hysterical Negro woman bursts open the door.
Mr. Creeley, the tank's on fire.
Which one?
The gasoline tank at the Standard Oil. Must have been struck by lightning.
Give me that raincoat.
Where are you going, Mr. Creeley?
I'm going up there to that tank and put the fire out.
Oh, no. Please, Mr. Creeley, don't do that. You'll be blown up.
Got to take a chance. Now, you run down to the railroad tracks and tell all the tenants to get to their houses. Now, hurry, now, quick.
Within a few moments, as the breathless, rain-soaked Negro woman dashes through the yard screaming an alarm which brings townsfolk, workers, and volunteer firefighters to the vicinity, George Crayley, his raincoat flapping in the wind, races for the gasoline tank. Quickly climbs up the 60-foot ladder to the lid, where from a crack opened by lightning there spurts a 6-foot arc of bluish flame fed by gasoline fumes. Underneath him are 110,000 gallons of gasoline, which, if touched off by one spark, will shatter the tank and the town. As the crowd of spectators cautiously at a distance stare upward, frozen with fear, the lightning flashes, silhouetting his thin form vividly against the black sky. George Crayley desperately plays a cat-and-mouse game with the treacherous fire, refusing all assistance. Fanning the weird flame with his rubber coat, Crayley attempts to smother it. First, he clears it from one spot, then sees it return to another. For 5 tense minutes, he jockeys the flame into position, a whole town weighing in the balance. Then, suddenly, simply, skillfully, he clutches the last small rim of fire under his rubber coat, holds it down tight till the flame is completely out. As he makes his way down into the yard again, town hero George Crayley answers grateful questioners thus.
I admit if the fire got hot enough to make the crack any wider, why, it would have been bad. But we don't like fires around here, and whenever I see any, I just got to put them out.
Today in London, with the future of the League of Nations perhaps hanging on decision of Great Britain, Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin makes an extraordinarily forthright foreign policy declaration. To British conservative women assembled in Albert Hall, exclaims conservative leader Baldwin,
I confess my disappointment over the League's performance in the Ethiopian dispute. But I am not disposed and I do not intend to accept the blame for what happened. It is well known that Britain did much more than anybody else. I have never held that the possible failure of the first experiment in sanctions should mean the end of the League. Far from it. The League should be reformed with a view toward bringing Japan, Germany, and the United States to Geneva. But the world must remember that League economic sanctions will never be likely to succeed unless the countries concerned with their enforcement are prepared for war.
Today in Vienna is struck a decisive blow in the rivalry which has dominated the Austrian political scene since the summer of 1934, when the assassination by Nazis of little Chancellor Engelbert Dollfuss left Austria with two rival dictators. Dictator number one,
Prince Ernst Rüdiger von Starhemberg, Führer of the potent 100,000-strong white fascist Heimwehr, regarded in Austria as his private army. Bootlicking hero worshipper of Benito Mussolini.
Dictator number two,
Chancellor Kurt von Schuschnigg, the Austrian regular army and his own Catholic storm troops at his command. Cautious counterpart of the late Chancellor Dollfuss, friend of Mussolini because he was forced to choose between Mussolini and Hitler.
From dictator number one to his idol in Italy early this week goes a curious telegram.
To His Excellency Benito Mussolini, Piazza Venezia, Rome. I congratulate you from my whole heart on the great triumph of the Italian fascist arms over the barbarism of Ethiopia and over the democratic dishonesty and hypocrisy of the League of Nations. Signed, Ernst Rüdiger von Starrenberg.
Appalled and dismayed by Starrenberg's ill-timed flouting of the League, old Herr Miklas, Austria's president, emerges from obscurity to call a hurried meeting of the cabinet last night.
I think the foreign minister owes us some explanation of the vice chancellor's action in sending the telegram to Signor Mussolini, a message with whose text he must have been acquainted.
Herr president.
The vice chancellor von Starrenberg.
I have no desire to hide behind the skirts of the foreign ministry. I take full responsibility for my telegram to Mussolini, and I will not back down on it.
Herr President.
Chancellor Schuschnigg.
Austria is not yet a province of Italy, even if Starrenberg would have it one.
I warn you, Schuschnigg. My storm troops of the Heimwehr are already furious at your threats to disband them. I hope it will not be necessary for them to take over the Austrian government in the name of my victorious fascist state.
I am sure that threat would frighten the regular army out of its wits. Herr President, in the interest of democracy, it is my duty to hand in the resignation of my cabinet.
I accept your cabinet's resignation, Herr Schuschnigg, and I designate you to form a new cabinet of your own choice.
Very well. I trust I will not have to ask for the resignation of Starrenberg and the foreign minister.
Schuschnigg, you have my resignation. But tomorrow, I leave for Rome. There I will talk with Mussolini. Tomorrow, who knows who will be master in Austria?
Frozen out of the cabinet, which he has bullied for nearly 2 years, Starrenberg wastes no time. Today, to all Heimwehr district commanders in Austria goes an official communique.
The resignation from Austria's cabinet of our leader, Prince von Starrenberg, is not the end but the beginning of our destiny as masters of Austria. The Heimwehr army is not to disband. Under no circumstances take orders from anyone but Starrenberg. Hold your troops in readiness for orders from our leader.
And roaring off this afternoon for Italy, would-be Duce Starrenberg is tonight ready to meet Il Duce. In a desperate effort to put Austro-Italian relations back on their former basis, Chancellor Schuschnigg wires friendly assurances to Mussolini. Thus, tonight, the future of Austria is straight up to Mussolini. But whether fascist Mussolini will tomorrow dare to back the fascist army of von Starrenberg in a coup to overthrow the Schuschnigg government, no man can predict. Today from Addis Ababa, Italian Ethiopia, comes report of a farewell visit to Emperor Vittorio Emanuele's viceroy, Pietro Badoglio, by two foreign news hawks.
Well, Marshal, the war is over. We're pulling out today for Djibouti and home with the rest of the newspaper correspondents.
My friends, it was a glorious adventure you and I had together, all the way to Addis Ababa. Yes, I suppose your job is over. You are not peace correspondents.
Pacifying Ethiopia will be a tough job for you, all right.
But we shall do it, as we did in Libya under my governorship there, with three weapons, doctors, teachers, and roads.
Well, if you ask me, Ethiopia can use all three, if you can make them like it.
Well, goodbye.
Goodbye, Marshal.
Goodbye, gentlemen. I want you all to go away with the memory of Italians as good soldiers, who did their best for their country over tremendous odds. And when in future years, seated at your hearths with your families, you look back on the day of taking Addis Ababa, I hope you will think of it, if not with nostalgia, at least as a pleasant memory.
As Marshal Badoglio puffs romantically over his military epic, genially tosses a forget-me-not for departing news hawks to treasure, from Aden today, says famed World War defender of the Dardanelles, Ethiopia's Turkish military advisor, Wahib Pasha.
Ethiopia was not conquered by Italian gas, bombs, or other modern weapons, but because the majority of Ethiopian chieftains succumbed to Italian bribery.
Today in London occurs an event which recalls to Englishmen one of the proudest of all the proud days of Britain's empire history. It is December 11th, 1917, in the Holy Land of Palestine. The day after the dramatic 2 weeks rush of the British forces has finally broken the power of the Turk with the climactic capture of Jerusalem. Standing stiffly at Jerusalem's great Jaffa Gate, surrounded by a crowd of curious Jew and Arab natives, is a guard of Allied troops. When, at exactly noon, down the dusty, sun-beaten Jaffa Road on foot, comes a little party of uniformed men.
Attention! Present arms!
General Allenby.
Captain.
Your guard of honor reporting for orders, sir.
Very well.
Which is he? Which is the man I seek?
Who's that tall fellow over there? What does he want?
He's one of the Arab leaders, General Allenby. He doesn't quite understand your position. Thinks he ought to talk to you. Shall I send him away?
By no means. I'll speak with him. Have him come over here.
Shemile kan Jupiter, Vendi.
Art thou the great king who has conquered this holy city of Jerusalem for the Christians?
I am commander of the troops who have occupied Jerusalem, yes.
Wilt thou cast down our Muslim shrines and drive out all before thee who are not Christians of thy faith?
Tell your people that I shall protect the shrines of the Muslims and of all faiths in Jerusalem.
Then indeed we are fallen into the hands of a just man. But what do thy people call this site?
I am General Allenby.
Allenby. Allenby. Then thou hast fulfilled a prophecy, Said.
Prophecy, sir?
It is an ancient legend of my people, Said, that he who shall deliver the holy city of Jerusalem and exalt her among the nations shall enter the city on foot, as thou art, and his name shall be God the Prophet, which in my tongue, Said, is Allenby.
Humbly and on foot, into the city of Jerusalem enters her first Christian conqueror since she fell to the hand of the Ottoman Empire 4 centuries ago, Britain's General Sir Edmund Allenby. With the completion of the most romantic exploit of the war, Edmund Allenby is decorated by 10 Allied nations, elevated to the peerage, made Knight Commander of the Bath, awarded the Cross of the Order of St. Michael and St. George, revered throughout the Christian world as the victorious leader of the Last Crusade. Then today, as it must to all men, death comes to Edmund Viscount Allenby, 75, who only 2 weeks ago, looking back upon his life, upon wars and rumors of wars, sums up the strange, unsoldierly philosophy of the second Christian conqueror of Jerusalem.
In all the world today, we find our best minds busy at devising new means of slaughter, building more horrible engines of destruction, brewing more atrocious poisons, and designing more monstrous methods of murdering their fellow men. Is this the sole conclusion to the war which was to end all wars? Where now is our victory? And where is the glory of our conquests? The gains of that war are the fruits of a dead sea, and their legacy is a cup of bitter memories.
Time marches on.
You are listening to The March of Time, the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the world, prepared and presented by the editors of Time.
Time marches on at high pressure these days. It's not like the old days when you could drive your car as you pleased. Now you stop and start at the traffic light and obey the finger of every cop on the road. It's tiresome. It gets on the nerves. That's why you should take a package of Wrigley's Spearmint Gum along. It will relax you, make you feel fresher. Won't you try this and convince yourself?
Again tomorrow night at this same hour, and every night, Monday through Friday, the March of Time.
Time marches on. This This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. WABC, New York.